own settings here, I think perhaps as much as any, some of the gospel ministers that have to deal with fresh contextualization of Christology are those involved in youth ministry, much as anything. And, you know, I hear in seeking to speak in relevant ways of Jesus Christ being referred to as the boss or the coach or the president or whatever, and ways that, you know, seek to give a fresh equivalent English contextual translation of kurios, and not to discard the good and proper word Lord, but to realize that that English term Lord is also first used and has continued to be used in a contextualized sort of a way, and that word Lord might not really register with some people. Not to mean that we therefore discard it, but to have some other words that are fresh and speak to what the Scriptures are saying is, I think, youth ministers in particular really have to work hard at that. All right. Our next category I have for you is Christ as conqueror and crucified. Just a few comments about that. That is almost this one rubric that comes out of different non-Western theologians, not just non-Western, but I'm thinking here specifically of a well-known Japanese author named Shusaku Endo. Few of you will be familiar with him. The best-known work that he wrote, entitled Silence, was about how God seemingly was silent in the early 1600s in Japan when so many Christians were suffering such awful persecutions and basically being stamped out by the government authorities in one of the most horrific, systematic, and, quote, successful persecutions of the Christian church ever in Christian history that took place. This, another book, where his Christology, and Endo himself, Japanese Roman Catholic, and died a few years ago, and wrote a number of books, one which was later than Silas' book called The Samurai, where it's a story of, again, set in the same historical time period in the 1630s, where some local samurai go off on a ship to Mexico and then eventually to Spain and to Rome. And it's this fascinating story. I would urge you to read it. It's a fascinating novel. But what comes out Christologically is that the Japanese, and Endo writes autobiographically in these sorts of ways, Japanese sensibilities would tend to be more towards the weak, suffering Christ, the crucified Christ. For example, the type of Christ that is being experienced and lived out amongst the poor indigenous, quote, Indians in Mexico that these Japanese travelers meet. And there's also more the conquering Christ the Spanish have brought into Mexico that is exhibited in Spain and in Rome. And there's this dual sort of Christology that Endo leaves you with this book, and he doesn't throw out either one. He notes implicitly his own instinctive longings for the crucified, weak Christ. But where Jesus is how he's understood, so writes Endo, is related to where and in what particular setting he's understood. It is striking to me when you read our hymns about Jesus and sing them, more often than not, we sing about the exalted, glorious Christ. Not exclusively, but more often than not. And that strikes me that perhaps that's related to the past several hundred years of our own history in this part of the world, of seeing Christ as the conquering King. You can think about that and mull over it as you will to do some self-contextualization. Cross-Cultural Dialogue is Theological Conversation is a title taken from the readings you did and William Dearness, who I think is retired now, but was a former dean of the School of Theology at Fuller Seminary, spent a number of his working years in the Philippines and gained a deep appreciation for the value of cross-cultural theological sharing. And in his readings at the end of a book, all of which you haven't read, entitled Imitation of Cross-Cultural Theology, is that the readings I gave you here at the end of that book, he notes that in evaluating different theologies taken up in different places to extrapolate and see what sorts of characteristics are important and can be correctives for different settings. One, he cites the need for historical perspective, and not all theological formulations that he has surveyed in his book from around the world embody that. He notes the importance of critical thinking, which is a particular heritage of those of us perhaps in the West, along with, in some ways, historical thinking. And then he notes an instrumental or functional understanding as opposed to substantive, and thinking about who Christ is for us, what he does for many people, more than kind of substantially defining metaphysically and ontologically who Christ is. And in the end, he notes that those can be correctives in different settings. As the gospel comes in, it's going to take fresh shape, and Jesus Christ and the understanding of Jesus Christ will take fresh shape in different settings. And to listen to each other across cultural boundaries, across contextual boundaries within the Christian church, is important to gain ever-increasing full understandings of who Jesus Christ in all of his universality and complexity and beauty and glory and majesty. Romans 1, 3, and 4, just to note this as an epilogue for us, it's more a matter of self-testimony, if you will. The first sermon that I ever preached in homiletics as a student at Covenant Seminary was on Romans 1, 1 through 7. And it stuck with me all these years. And I recall specifically verses 3 and 4 and how for myself, I wasn't thinking missiologically and contextually at the time, but in retrospect, I can see where it was a contextual corrective for me when I dealt with these verses. Paul, in Romans 1, is dealing with the gospel about his son. He notes in verse 2, this gospel which he promised beforehand God did through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures. Then verses 3 and 4. Concerning his son, who is born of a descendant of David according to the flesh, who is declared the Son of God with power by the resurrection from the dead, according to the Spirit of holiness, Jesus Christ our Lord. Now, when I first encountered those verses, and then when I went to the commentaries to confirm what I was sensing, my sense was this is talking about the humanity and the deity of Christ. Verse 3, concerning his son who was born of a descendant of David according to the flesh. Okay, it's talking about his human nature. And verse 4, who is declared the Son of God with power by the resurrection from the dead according to the Spirit of holiness, Jesus Christ our Lord. It's talking about his divinity. Well, fair enough. But one or two commentaries noted that, well, wait a minute though. When you go back to what was in Paul's mind, for him it was more of a historical progression of Christ, the humiliated one, the one who had come to be among us, being exalted as the Son of God and declared to be so by the resurrection of from the dead. It's a historical progression here. Not that noticing the human and divine natures here is wrong. Not to say that these verses don't lend support for seeing the two natures of the single person, of the second person, the Trinity. But that's looking through later lenses, and my instinctive notion to that was due to my inheriting that particular context. Again, a positive development given the situations through which Christological understandings have come. But when you read what Paul is writing here, it's more the historical progression of Jesus being humiliated than exalted. That's the point. And realizing my own instincts due to my background, realizing the contextual setting within which those formulations were developed, can maybe help allow us to hear the Scriptures afresh in all of their fullness and not simply be locked into particular interpretations only, that are right, that are orthodox, but may not be complete and fair to what the Scriptures meant in the original sense. That was just a personal example of something where, you know, fresh hermeneutics is very closely tied in with what we're talking about here. All right, our time is slipping away. I'm ready to move on unless you want to pursue something else on this particular topic. All right, let's go then to topic 19, modern empires into Christendom. Before we do so, let me mention a couple of books on your supplemental reading list. I haven't mentioned yet. I'm just going down that particular list. I think one work in there listed by Howard, Moving Out, that is about the late 19th, early 20th century student volunteer movement. And if I'm not mistaken, we have a few Xerox copies up in the library up on the third floor. If you're interested in obtaining that for a nominal fee, as I recall, you can come see me or the faculty secretary about that. But that moving out is about the important student volunteer movement. The next couple of books are by Patrick Johnstone. The Church is Bigger Than You Think is a book that he brought out a few years ago. Some of the graphs I show you in this class are taken from here. The title of the book carries a little different meaning than what I originally thought. I thought when I saw the title of this book, he was going to be talking more about the worldwide scope of the Church. But instead, what he's speaking for here is that too often this is his argument, that our ecclesiologies keep us from fully embracing so-called parachurch organizations as part of the organized church. He wants to suggest that when you look at what's happened in Christian history, you've needed those so-called parachurch organizations to carry out various ministries in the church. They've always been there, and should we not see them as part of the organized church? He uses and picks up some of Ralph Winter's terminology, distinguishing between sodalities and modalities. And sodalities are those more specialized organizations like the monasteries, like modern mission organizations, sometimes called parachurch groups. And the modalities are more the, quote, established, recognized church structures. He wants to say that let's recognize all of them as part of the organized church. Now, that brings certain questions to the fore about what does it mean about then church discipline, the sacraments, those sorts of things. But nevertheless, that's what he wants to argue in the book. Helpful historical matters about missions, activities, etc., etc. Many of you will know this book, also by Pastor Johnson, Operation World. The latest edition, I understand, is now available. And I have received the latest information, about 800 numbers and email addresses that you can use to acquire the latest edition of Operation World, which has a country-by-country description of the situation, religious and other situations of countries in the world. Very helpful prayer guide. And it's also available in CD-ROM. If you're interested in obtaining that, why don't you email me and I can send you that information if you would like. This could be a tool for congregations, any number of Sunday school groups, families, personally, etc. Absolutely. One of the most comprehensive. It's designed to be a prayer guide for all parts of the world. And it's been widely influential in evangelical mission circles. And this newest edition has been widely anticipated. All right, modern empires and the end of Christendom. One of the main points to realize from this topic is that when you look at Christian history in general and the cross-cultural missionary spread of the Christian faith in particular, it takes place within history and intertwined with general history. We can separate for analysis' sake and God works in particular ways in redemptive history as he is providentially governing general history. But those two are going to be intertwined. And when you see, and we're going to be looking at the last 200 years right now, when you look at what's happened at the cross-cultural spread of the gospel over the past 200 years, of the very closely intertwined nature of that missions movement and general history is very, very clear. For example, you look at the port town in northern Japan of Hakodate. It's on the northernmost tip of the main island of Honshu in Japan, and an important port town for Western powers as they were starting to encroach upon Japan and wanting to deal with Japan in the mid-19th century. Japan had been in a period of seclusion for over 200 years. Since the 1630s, basically. By the time you get to the 1850s, the Western powers, all of them, want to relate to Japan. It's just too important for any number of reasons. It's right next door to China, for example. That's why it's particularly important to the Americans. When you go and look at the development of Hakodate then as a city, and you can see, I've never been there, but I've seen these on film, and you look at some of the buildings that were constructed in the 1860s, for example. And you see some church buildings. It's very striking, some of the main church buildings you see there in downtown Hakodate. You see an Orthodox church, very close to each other, an Orthodox church, Catholic church, and an Anglican church. All beautiful church buildings, all separate and all right close to each other. Now guess who built and then guess who worshipped in the Orthodox church? The Russians. Guess who built and worshipped in the Catholic church? Let me ask an easier question first. Guess who built and worshipped in the Anglican church? The British, and they let the Americans come in as well. The Catholic church was built and used by the French. French was Catholic, France was Catholic, Russia was Orthodox, Britain was Anglican. And the close alliance of those particular nations with those particular brands of Christianity was very closely intertwined. And you can't separate out the national identity of those churches, those particular churches, from the quote-unquote denominational affiliation of them, because they're just too closely intertwined. And those sorts of intertwined relationships are characteristic of much of the last, especially the 19th, early 20th century spread of the Christian faith via the West. Look at Africa, for example. French colonies are going to be primarily Catholic as far as the spread of Christianity goes. Same with Portugal. British colonies are going to be primarily Anglican. And so, for example, today, even in a post-colonial period, when you talk about the Church of Uganda or the Church of Kenya, you're talking about the Anglican Church as former British colonies. That's just reality as modern empires spread and Christianity spread with modern empires. Now, going back a little bit in history for the ancient medieval European background of the modern imperial powers, you have various characteristics that are picked up over the centuries. With the ecumenical councils, with the need to define the faith, with the need to define what heresy is and what is orthodoxy, and the close association often of the calling of those councils and the definition of orthodoxy, you have a combined creedal precision that develops along with imperial power. And that's certainly the case as it takes shape after Constantine. And so the division that arises after the fall of the Roman Empire, but where you still have the continuing Byzantine Empire and the developing vestiges of what the Roman Empire involved in other parts of Europe, and the developing of the Roman Church, Nestorianism is cut off and defined heretical because the precise language is different. And the political, cultural connections with that are clear enough. So that's one part of the background of needing to be creedally precise, and that's combined with imperial power as well. Then, as the Christian faith spreads into, takes hold in various European nations, you have the strengthening of the notion of territorial Christian nations. This nation under this kingdom is Christian. That is the religion of this territory. Period. Within other kingdoms, what their religious faith is, I mean, throughout Europe it eventually comes to be Christianity, but that ruler's Christianity, that kingdom's Christianity alone is what is tolerated in that territory. And that is what is here, and what is elsewhere is different. And that develops and strengthens over the centuries, particularly as Europe becomes threatened by Islam. And Islam starts to threaten Europe fairly early, especially after the Crusades. As the Mongols spread into the 13th century, and the Ottoman Turks spread in the 14th, 15th century, I mean, Europe is in danger of being overrun. And Hungary is like the eastern outpost of Christendom in defense against the infidels. And so you have a strengthening. And just remember here now, too, you don't have the sort of global consciousness that we tend to have today. I mean, the world is much smaller, much more enclosed and insular for people. It's interesting to note with the Protestant Reformation, and this map is not big enough to note this very clearly, but when you look at where the Protestant Reformation occurred, basically in northern and western Europe. Basically, you can see a similar divide between where the Protestant Reformation takes hold and where the Catholic Church stays strong. You can see a basic divide between the old Roman Empire and the northern European nations. Similar, with some small exceptions. But basically, when you think about what remains Catholic and what goes Protestant, what some people have pointed out then is to say it's certainly not unrelated, the underlying civilizations and different cultures. You have the old Roman Mediterranean culture into which the Roman Church has taken firm hold and put down deep roots. But with the spread of that Latin Christianity into northern and western Europe, that remains somewhat foreign. But with the Protestant Reformation and with the translation of the scriptures into indigenous tongues, into English, Luther's translation of the scriptures into German, etc., you have more of a contextualization of the Christian faith into those northern and western European settings. Yes. Or it became contextualized in their settings in the same way that the Latin faith had become contextualized in the Roman Church's settings. And now some people want to use that as the total explanation for the Protestant Reformation. That's simplistic and reductionist. There's much more at work there than simply cultural factors. But I think that is part of it. But even with that, even with the coming of the Protestant Reformation, you do not have a doing away with the notion of Christian territories. You'll know in the wake of the Reformation, you have all these religious wars fought. That's because there's only one type of religion that is tolerated in certain areas. That's just the way it is. This becomes Lutheran territory. This becomes Reformed territory. This is Catholic, whatever it might be. And that remains in Europe up to, really, the spread of the Christian faith out of Europe. Yes. The Orthodox Church in Eastern Europe and on into Russia, basically from a thousand, starting with Cyril and Methodius in the late 9th century in Central Europe and then in other parts of Eastern Europe, though the Orthodox Church in its various forms takes shape in Eastern Europe and in Russia. And we'll look particularly at the spread of Russia and the role that Russia plays in the modern missions movement. The rest of the Orthodox Church doesn't really have the political and economic might for those nations to spread. I mean, they're right up next to Islam, to Islamic countries. They're kind of sandwiched in between the other European powers and Islamic nations, and so they don't have the wherewithal to spread. But Russia is an exception there. And as we'll point out, Russia plays a very important role in the modern missions movement. And so when you see the modern empire spreading, much of the spread of European powers is due to their being rivals with each other. I mean, Spain and Portugal spread around the world, and the English and the Dutch don't spread in the same sort of colonial way. Now, remember, differences between Spain and Portugal. Spain goes and conquers the Americas, conquers, names the Philippines. Portugal doesn't have the resources, nor the will, nor is the setting around Africa and in Asia suitable for setting up colonial powers, new colonies. It just doesn't happen with Portugal. And the English and the Dutch aren't ready to be the same type of world power that Spain becomes. That's going to change with the defeating of the Spanish Armada in the 1580s, and if you remember world history, but it's through the trading companies into Asia and into the Americas that the English and the Dutch spread. And wherever they go, they're rivals with the Spanish. And you'll see in various places around Africa and in Asia and in the Americas, the Protestant powers and the Catholic powers doing battle with each other in various ways, taking over slave castles and forts along the coast of Africa, for example, saying bad things about each other in Japan in the early 1600s. Russia is ever spreading eastward. Russia signs a treaty for the first time, for example, with China in 1689. and Russia is ever spreading across Siberia. And different Russian sailors and traders, for example, will occasionally show up on the Japanese coast in the 18th century, on into the early 19th century, when it's totally forbidden. And oftentimes they're jailed and killed, or they're sent back quickly. But Russia, through its spread, and with them the Orthodox Church, sees tremendous missionary success among native peoples in eastern Russia, in what we call Alaska. Tremendous success here, especially in the 19th century and in the late 19th century in Japan. The Russian Orthodox Church spread significantly. But all the while, as Russia is spreading, it has its eye on what the Brits are doing. And the feeling is mutual. You know, the Crimean War in the 1850s. Other wars fought later. Are rivalries between Russia and Britain and France. But it spreads all around Asia, and you see that, those rivalries spreading. For example, when you enter the 1900s, Japan and Britain sign a military alliance in 1902. Why? They're both concerned about Russia. They're going to be allies against the Russians. Well, Japan has just defeated China in war in 1894-95, and after the war, Japan is rooked out of what it probably should have been given after the war, and it's the French and the Dutch and the Russians who start grabbing power and land and resources in the Korean Peninsula in the wake of the Japanese victory over China in the 1890s. That leads to war between the Japanese and Russia in 1904-1905. And they slug it out, almost exhaust each other, and Japan is left standing at the end. The Americans help broker a peace, and British support helps, and Russia is defeated. And that kind of begins the end of the inexorable Western spread around the world. But that alliance between the Brits and the Japanese shows how the Brits and the Russians are concerned about each other. And everywhere in the world, as the European powers carve up Africa beginning in the 1880s, when King Leopold II of Belgium goes into Central Africa and wants a monopoly on the rubber trade, when that happens, the Europeans are competing against each other. And you know how they draw the lines at a meeting in Europe between all the different colonies. Many of these lines make absolutely no sense from an African perspective, but that's just the way they were drawn, to create a balance of power. The reason that Thailand is never colonized by European powers in Asia, it's the only country in Asia not colonized. I mean, Japan was not colonized in a unique way. And China effectively was. But Thailand wasn't, because the British and the French agreed to leave it as a buffer state between themselves to prevent war. That's what's happening. And it's in that setting that the Christian faith is spreading through the Western powers. Okay, Germany then comes on the scene, formed in 1871, relatively late as a modern nation state. And Germany, therefore, doesn't have very many colonial possessions at all in Africa and Asia, just a few. And therefore, when World War I breaks out and they lose their colonial possessions, it's really not, it's significant enough in parts of West Africa, and off the coast of China, a few places that they lose, but they're not as major a player. But Britain is always watching Germany and vice versa, leading up into World War I. Then the Americans. The Americans are hot on the scene, really from the mid-19th century, as the U.S. is spread across the continent, and the U.S. becomes very active in Asia. The real prize for the Americans is China, and as far as Britain is concerned, Japan is almost too far away, so the Americans don't have a monopoly on Western trade with Japan by any means, but they're the most significant players. And it's in all of these different settings that missionaries from these different countries are going, setting up shop, and ministering. And when the European powers, for example, Christian leaders meet in 1910 in Edinburgh, and they're confirming their comity agreements, who is ministering where? Who's taking care of church planting, evangelism in certain parts of the world? You can basically line those up with where their countries have colonial authority. I mean, it only makes sense. That's what's happened. Now, after Edinburgh 1910, things start to change somewhat. The colonial era will go through World War II, but Japan has defeated Russia at war. You have, with the two world wars, a shattering of European confidence vis-a-vis the rest of the world. You have a questioning among many Christian people. You've had the rise of theological liberalism out of Germany in the mid-19th century. That contributes towards some of the thinking. You have evolutionary thought coming into the scene. Some European Christian leaders start to think, well, is Christianity really going to take over the world the way we thought that it would? And what about these wonderful Hindu people that we see in India that aren't coming to Christ the way we thought that they would? And look at the wonderful morals that they have and the incredible heritage that they have. Should we really try to do away with that, or should we learn from that and respect that? After the two world wars, the United States increases in prestige and influence. And if I haven't mentioned it before, I'll mention it now. Really, through the 19th century up until World War I, the main country that sends out the most missionaries compared to any other country is Britain. They have the resources. They have the British Empire, the empire in which the sun never sets. But after World War I, the nation who now has more missionaries elsewhere than any other nation becomes the United States. And it's stayed that way up until today. By the way, side note for no extra charge, the latest statistics in the World Christian Encyclopedia show that, contrary to what some of us have thought and contrary to what some of us have said, is that as far as international cross-cultural missionaries are concerned, those leaving their particular nations of residency and where their citizenship is, while many of us have thought and said that third world countries now produce more missionaries than Western countries, that is not the case. By far, most Christians live in a two-thirds world, but it is still the case that the majority of missionaries go elsewhere from Western nations. About 52% of missionaries leaving their countries go out from Western nations. Now, that statistic can shift a bit when you factor in cross-cultural missionaries within nation states. For example, within India and within Brazil. Big nations with many different people groups, with a lot of cross-cultural missionary activity going on within those nations. But as far as international missionaries are concerned, due to continuing economic resources and relative vitality of Christianity in the United States, the majority of missionaries still go from Western nations and particularly from the United States. And the United States remains the single largest producer of cross-cultural missionaries. After World War II, the world continues to change, with nations throughout Africa and Asia becoming independent of their colonial authority. The first nation to become independent after World War II in Africa was Ghana, former Gold Coast, 1957. The UN is created, of course, and the Cold War kind of shapes the way we view the world. East and West become, you know, the Soviet bloc and the free world, the world of liberal democracies. But now that we're in a post-Cold War setting, and that's been brought home all the more with recent terrorist events, the world is different. It's changing. And the better we catch up with the worldwide reality of the Christian church within a new sort of a world where, even now, where we try to come up with what war looks like in a new world, we have to catch up with ever-changing realities. Nevertheless, Christian churches have a very powerful, strong, those of us in the West, Christendom heritage. And your readings in Schenck, I think, point this out in some very helpful, revealing ways, I would suggest to you. One quotation I've taken from his page 120. All churches in the West are heirs to one degree or another of a Christendom understanding of the church. This is the basic vision of the church that missionaries from the West took with them to other parts of the world. So the Christian faith enters, becomes established, and then maintains its existence and maintains a status quo. And missions, therefore, only is what occurs in settings that don't yet have the church. And the mission, the essential missionary character of the church, wherever we are, gets lost because of this Christendom heritage. It's where the church already is. That's not where missions takes place. What are you talking about? And you can see where that feeds the background of our notions of what missions is. Missions is what we do out there. Is it a possible difference of semantics, whereas where the church already is, you start calling it evangelism and not missions? I would say yes and no. And representing him, I would say it's more of a no. In that, for us, evangelism becomes seeing people come to believe in Christ. To where missions, he and others want to argue, and I agree with this, needs to be seen as more than simply people coming to believe in Christ. God's world mission is the redemption of the triune, redemption of the cosmos of the triune God, wherein he grants among all the world's peoples faith in Jesus Christ, maturing of the church, and foretaste of the new heavens and the new earth. And that more comprehensive notion of what mission is what needs to undergird what we're all about as being missional people who are never fully settled at home wherever we are. And so in that sense, insofar as the church does become settled and outreach becomes only evangelism, that is a sign of it being kind of a Christendom setting. And so there is an overlap, and it is semantic in that one sense, in that outreach always continues. But insofar as the church kind of gets settled, it's fixed, it's set up, and you maintain what's there, that shows a more Christendom heritage. Yes. Does it also include the society being implemented, the society that is carried with the missionaries? Certainly what happens in the modern missions movement, and we're quite sensitive to this now, more so than before, is yes, people who are going out within a Christendom setting, with some exceptions, but are going to carry with them what they believe to be their Christian society and the way things are done with respect to law, with respect to social customs, with respect to families, what have you. What Dr. Schenck is also wanting to point out here as well is that insofar as churches, many churches in the West, including in the United States, exhibit a Christian heritage, a Christendom heritage, they basically are out to maintain the socio-political status quo where we are in the West. That basically we see that the system of the socio-political system in the way that it is practiced and all the values that it stands for, where we find ourselves, is Christian and right. And we are fully for it. And we are enmeshed within it. And we are for maintaining fully the way things are. Like democracy, like the practice of liberal democracy, the full practice of capitalism, the whole shebang, the way political rights are understood, all those sorts of things. Now, I don't hear Dr. Schenck saying that the Christian church should therefore, if it's doing it right, be socio-political revolutionaries. I don't hear him saying that. But I do hear him saying, and I would concur with this, that the Christian church, if it's going to be properly missional, really needs to be able to maintain a critical distance from its setting so that it can make critical remarks about the status quo that are not going to be right. Is there ever going to be a situation in this world that's going to be fully right? You can be for democracy, you can be for political rights, you can be for freedom of speech, you can be for freedom of religion. But does that mean that you are for everything that this society stands for? A Christendom sort of a settling in would make you so particularized, contextualized, where you become syncretized to the setting. And you can't really have the universal character of the Christian faith inform you enough to be alien and strangers. If you have your Schenck, turn to chapter 9 and flip through with me from pages 118 and following, where he elaborates on some of these comments, where he notes some of the historical background of the church and again, where the church in the West gets settled and missions in its activist kind of a mindset only becomes related to what occurs out there. And so what he wants to argue, he notes at the top of page 120, first full paragraph, he wants to argue three things. One, we need to reclaim a biblically informed metaphor for the church-world relationship. And he goes on to say that's going to be aliens and strangers, like Peter talks about, for example. That we consider missionary encounter as the normative description of the role of the church in relation to the world. And thirdly, we could do well to appropriate learnings from experience of what was happening in the past 2 years about what missionary encounter really does involve. He goes on under missionary encounter on page 122 to say that within Christendom, the entire population or society had to be Christian. No place was given to mission. It was a one-time step, Christianization was. Everyone becomes Christian, then you maintain the political, religio-political status quo. And therefore, missions really has to arise from outside the church structures that are so set in an ecclesiastical formality and fixed nature. And so some of the cross-cultural lessons from the bottom of 124 that he notes. One, just noting the sense of frontier that has come out of much of what has occurred in cross-cultural missions in our day is important, whether that be across ethnic lines or religious lines. We need to rediscover what it means to live on the edge of frontier. We need to learn the objective study of culture. And again, I would encourage you, I think it's very tricky in our evangelical circles today to know what we're talking about when we talk about the culture. Because when we talk about the culture infecting us and controlling us, we're talking about our general surroundings. We don't really hone in on these cultures within which we find ourselves being part of worldwide different sorts of cultures. And we confuse the word the way we use it. That's not necessarily bad the way the word is used in either sense, but I think we need to be clear in our minds in which way we're using it. We need to learn to read culture and have a sort of a critical engagement with culture here in the West. And so at the very beginning of this section on page 117, he notes that the church in the West is being called to rid itself of time-worn habits of thought and engage in the demanding work of rethinking its relationship to contemporary culture through the lens of mission. Again, I think that's happening in our circles. I think we've seen how much things have changed the past generation, and people are sensing that we're not fully at home, that the church has been displaced from its place of comfort and being able to issue edicts. It's particularly critical in times like these, when you're entering a period of war, like the United States is now entering, to be able to be critically engaged, seems to me, to have that capacity to be fully involved, to care about what's happening, to care about your country, to have love of country, and yet at the same time to not allow that to become the all in all, because the modern nation state, including the United States of America, will seek to be absolute in its demands for loyalty. And there are religious overtones into those who are martyrs for their country or whatever it might be. I find it difficult when I hear Christians, saying, for example, to all of you out there in the military, Jesus is with you and leading you. I find that difficult and syncretistic. How to be supportive of your country, how to care and appreciate the sacrifices and dangers encountered by those in the military without giving your soul in an absolute sense to the nation state. Is what we're called to, as being aliens and strangers. And it's because of a Christendom heritage, even though we have a separation of church and state in this country, it is not always easy to draw lines, and the lines are oftentimes very fuzzy. And I would encourage you to remember the particular and universal aspects of who we are as the Lord's people to help give that necessary distance for being able to critique what's happening. And as you see it, don't you see people either going to one extreme or the other? It's difficult to walk a critical line. I mean, some people just want to say, protest against anything. That's wrong, that's bad. All war, all whatever, that's bad, we're against it. And then some people can't see beyond the flag. That's all that's involved. And how to let the Christian faith inform us is not always easy, but very important. Yes? Insofar as justice is being pursued and thinking in the concrete, to carry a little further what you just said, thinking in the concrete about the United States leading a coalition against terrorists and bringing proper justice in this current situation, can we not as Christians say that that is Christian mission activity in the broadest sense? Lifting out a Christian ideal. That gets tricky. And how to allow for God's comprehensive missional activity, God's providential rule, while coupling that with the constant tension that no particular nation is going to fully embody the kingdom of God. And I think what's important too, to add in always, is what realities do Christian people in various parts of the world, in various countries, what do they have to say about matters like justice? That all needs to, and other factors, need to go into our kind of sense of evaluating and thinking about what you're exploring there, I think. You know, again, to be for the implementation of justice and yet temper that with, okay, what are the concerns of the Christians in Pakistan? What are the concerns of so many Christians in Japan who are emailing me right now about military buildup and concern about that? How do I factor that into my own understanding of where God is at work and how I pray? That's part of the whole mix. It's tricky.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
What can we
it's tricky, and it takes sensitivity. It takes close walking with Christ. It takes careful ears to listen. It takes the sensibility of being aliens and strangers. How to note as when you're preaching, when you're pastors, insofar as you're a public figures, how your congregation perceives you, how your community perceives you, various aspects of your community, how other Christians in other parts of the world that you might know, how they perceive your actions. You know, not just to act to please everyone, but to help that guide, I think, is part of the mix. And it's not an easy road to walk, especially when it's a new road like this one. Yes. Does someone else have a question or a comment?
Just a comment.
Comment. Go ahead.
I don't know how this
picture overlap. Having the cross be superimposed on the flag as opposed to having the flag wrapped across and be predominant. Yes. It could be, if indeed what was feeding that excuse they were given, if it was kind of an imported notion of the separation of church and state, if they were using that as an excuse, that would be one way that something would need to be brought in. Or as he points out, in that setting it needed to be worked out in a different Ghanaian sort of a way. Yeah. Yes. 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 The interfaith meeting, for example, the one that was held in Forest Park. There were several, yeah, and there was a big rally that some radio stations sponsored about the current situation and praying for the nation. What concerned me about that interfaith meeting that focused on praying for our nation, was the way it was put, was that it was, to me, you have different spheres of the world: faith, religion, ethics, politics, economics, etc. All of which is under the rule of God, but each of these areas of life has its own integrity. When it was an interfaith service on behalf of the nation, that struck me as one of these spheres, the religious sphere, giving itself to be subsumed within a more comprehensive and all-encompassing political sphere, and allowing the nation state to become an all in all, was my concern. Now, it would be fine with me if there's a gathering to you know, a patriotic rally or something like that. And it becomes tricky in this country when religion is brought into it because of the civil religion that we have. And how to appreciate that is not easy. But it seemed to me that, those different religious representatives were allowing the nation state to become too comprehensive in that, in praying for our nation. And so personally, I did not participate in those. Well, again, that's another issue. I mean, praying with other religions, yeah, what does that mean? I mean, interreligious dialogue to me can be very, very helpful. But praying with people who do not pray in Jesus' name, through Jesus, acknowledge Jesus as Savior as Lord, that's not going to do that. That's another factor that enters into that particular matter too. But again, a patriotic rally that might even bring in some civil religious matters that would include adherence of various religions, if that was focused more on being a patriotic political matter, that to me is easier to participate in than, and I'd be much more willing to support that than something that is religiously driven on behalf of the nation. Yeah. And then God is kind of reduced to a common denominator of being for the United States or whatever nation it might be. Yes. That's an excellent question. How is it that Christian people rightly carry out God's cultural mandate to bring that in, to bring to bear God's standards, God's law, God's kingdom within their particular cultures and societies? That certainly is a calling to which we have been sent, into which we have been sent as the Lord's people. One interesting factor in that is that for many of us in the West, we have as our heritage a notion that all of society is Christian, and this society, in comparison to other societies, is Christian and they're non-Christian. The experience of most Christians in the world is that the Christian church is a minority. We're socially displaced, and we truly are aliens and strangers. And so those different experiences, I think, help color our aspirations and expectations in being about the cultural mandate. And so how to be about bringing to bear the standards of God, what the Bible has to say about all aspects of life, socio-political matters included, but doing that with a realistic notion that we are aliens and strangers and we're waiting for the full redemption of the world, to me is what needs to be factored in to the experience that those of us who've had a Western Christendom as our background need to hear. So that's a helpful, very helpful reality to bring into it. And to note the historical differences between the experience of those of us in the West and those in the non-West. One example of that. For me, being a Christian in Japan, and with all due respect to people like Jack Collins, and I haven't spoken with him about this, I find it inconceivable, living as a Christian in Japan, to believe postmillennialism and to think that postmillennialism would have ever arisen as an understanding. You're such a minority there. Now, again, it might just be one saying, oh, just like a faith and reading the Bible or whatever, but I think how the context you're in helps shape those sorts of notions. And the fact that postmillennialism arose in certain places in the West when it did tells that context too. That's a little separate notion of what you're asking. What the point you've made is a very helpful one. And it's not to say that we become socially quietist or reckless as we're to be engaged. But again, what our expectations are, what our place in society is, needs to factor in the actual situation and the histories that we have. All right. Thank you. Your question for your readings next time. I'm sorry we've gone a few minutes over, but try to relate modern developments in Latin American Christianity to developments in modern mission theory. You'll be reading about Latin American Christianity, and you'll be reading, this is the bottom one for topics 21 and 22. Relate modern developments in Latin American Christianity to developments in modern mission history. And I don't think I gave you the question just to guide you in your readings for this time either, which is to relate the development or lack thereof during the previous two centuries of modern mission theory to the Christendom context of Western mission initiatives.